Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Past Imperfect. I'm Alice Thompson.
And I'm Rachel Sylvester. And we're talking to extraordinary people who've overcome trauma or adversity to achieve great success.
Our guest today is a man who is instantly recognisable, but hard to pigeonhole. Eddie Marsden is a character actor with an incredible versatility who has starred in films including Vice, Deadpool, as well as the US television crime drama Ray Donovan and Grange Hill.
He's won a clutch of awards and worked with some of the most famous directors in the world, including Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg and Mike Leigh. But he left school at 15, got a job as a printer's apprentice and only started acting in his 20s.
His father was a lorry driver, his mother a teaching assistant, and he grew up in an East London council estate. I'm not what's fashionable at the moment, which is good-looking public school boys who make a film and then advertise Burberry bomber jackets, he says. I'm just not that type.
Eddie Marsden, thank you very much for joining us on Past Imperfect. I can't think who you were possibly thinking of with the floppy hair and the Burberry bomber jacket. Do you feel that acting is too dominated by handsome older Tonians and older Harrovians with freckles and floppy hair?
Yeah, I kind of do, but I have to be very careful because I don't like the divisive rhetoric. I mean, a lot of my friends are old Tonians with floppy hair, good-looking boys, and I know what they've gone through. They've gone through their fair share of rejection, and also I've benefited from the kindness of people who have a much more privileged education and upbringing than me. I'm not one to think that wealth or lack of wealth is any indication of character. The easiest thing for me to do would to be a working class hero, and it's something that I would be disingenuous and I wouldn't be comfortable kind of portraying that. I think one of the problems is Idris Elba made a really good point. He said, talent is everywhere, but opportunity isn't. And I think that's the best way to look at it. Because some of these guys who go on to be, who are, you know, the floppy-haired public school boys, they're very talented and they deserve their success. They're not successful because they're floppy-haired public school boys. They're successful because they're good actors. The problem is there's a lot of good actors from less privileged backgrounds who never get that opportunity. That's all.
And is it also that acting is a job where you have to take a risk? You might not earn money for quite a long period of time to start with. So you have to have enough wealth or financial security to take that risk.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and also with the idea of taking loans now for college education and drama school, it's very expensive. Yeah, you have to be. I mean, I didn't earn a living as an actor till I was nearly 30. I was a waiter, a labourer, I'd go back and do printing, I'd work in a menswear shop, I'd do everything. I'd take all these kind of jobs, what I suppose now you'd call the gig economy, where you could leave at the drop of a hat if you got a job, if you got a pantomime or something, I used to get a lot of crime monthlies, and you'd go and do a crime monthly. I did every crime in London. And so, yeah, that was difficult. And it's easier if you have the bank of mum and dad.
And tell us about your childhood. You spent your early years on a pretty tough East End council estate. What was it like?
My parents had a very difficult marriage. So my home life was quite disruptive. But the community that I lived in was my salvation, really. I took refuge in community that I lived in. So there was lots of boys where I grew up, lots of boys whose fathers had court orders not to come anywhere near the house, like 100 yards near the house. My father had a similar situation. He had a very difficult marriage with my mum and a difficult divorce. So we all grew up with a certain amount of chaos. And if you look back, if you look at us all now, lots of us have far exceeded expectations. I've got a friend of mine, David Hermit, he's the chief executive of a multi-academy organization. He was a teacher, and he now runs a multi-academy and organization. My friend Emmanuel is an artist, and one of the guys who started his printing apprenticeship with me now runs a printing business. So I'm not the exception. And when we all get together and talk, from what I gather from it is that it was the need to have autonomy because of the chaos. We never really had very good positive father figures. And so we needed to find a sense of autonomy and control of our life because we were subject to such chaos.
And was there a lot of violence as well, either at home or in the estate?
Yeah, there was lots of domestic violence and there was lots of violence on the estate. The National Front were always walking through. Most of my friends were black. Most of my friends were, there was a big St. Lucian population in the East End. So most of my friends were St. Lucian or Caribbean of one kind or another. And so there was lots of racial violence. There was lots of violence in pubs as well. Used to get into fights a lot. And you know, I've been in a few scrapes. And at times it was very hard. And it was very, there was a lot of violence. Yeah. Lots of people getting stabbed. Lots of people getting glassed. I'd always come, even when I was an actor, I'd come back from a rehearsal somewhere. It was really weird. I was still living in Bethnal Green, but I was rehearsing plays in rehearsal room somewhere with a load of really, like doing an Albert Camus existentialist play, and I'd be doing rehearsing this play, and I'm playing Caligula, and I'd come back to Bethnal Green, and I'm sitting on a train trying to read Albert Camus and trying to understand the philosophy of existentialism, and I come off the train, and there was a guy in the East End, Bethnal Green, called Puggy Knowles, who was quite what I suppose you'd call handy. He was quite a tough guy of the area. And I remember coming off the train and having this Albert Camus book in my hand, and this Bethnal Green bloke came up to me and said, "Oh, I heard Puggy Knowles is after you." And I had no idea why. I'm trying to understand Albert Camus and existentialism. I was struggling to understand. And then all of a sudden I had to find out why Puggy Knowles was after me. And I had no idea. Actually, someone else went out of work, quiet word with him, and said it was all a mistake. But things like that happened all the time, all the time.
And did you have to learn to play a role on the estate, do you think? Did you have to either decide to be more submissive or to stand up to the aggressors or be part of a group? Were you always acting, do you think, even then?
No, I wasn't always acting. What I had was I took refuge. There was a St. Lucian family. They were called the Mitchell family, and I'm still very close to them. Their mum, Mrs. Mitchell, Joyce Mitchell, is, to me, she's always been mum, so I always call her mum. And I would go to their house all the time. They had six children, so she would always feed me and always be there. Her door was always open, and there was always food on the table. So I kind of took refuge with them, and I benefited, and I realise now in hindsight that there's something about an immigrant mentality which is more long-term than an indigenous white working class mentality. The white working class mentality that I was born into was very short-termism. Everything was about, because of poverty, you couldn't think beyond the next week or the next 2 weeks. So everything was immediate. And then that meant there was an incredible generosity, but there was also tendency for irresponsibility. But if you grew up spending a lot of time with immigrants, people who had come thousands of miles to give their children a better life, you suddenly realized about education and long-term thinking. So I benefited from that. And actually the people that I was most afraid of and felt most vulnerable with were the white working class racists. And the people I felt safest with were the immigrants on my estate.
What about in your own family? Was your dad ever violent with your mum?
I can't know. All I can say is they had a very difficult relationship. My father's, both his parents died by the time he was 12. And they were actually born, he was actually born on Cable Street. I sound like Jeremy Corbyn now. But he actually was born on Cable Street. And but he was one of nine, and I think six or seven of them died of TB. So he had a very traumatic childhood. My mother was a very bright young girl. She got into a grammar school from Bethnal Green, and she's one of the first people from Bethnal Green to get into this grammar school. But her father took his own life when she was 15 because he had mental illness, and she had to leave school to help provide for the family. So both my parents had very, very traumatic childhoods. And then they married quite relatively young and had four kids in a very, very... The first house was in Mile End, which was an absolute kind of slum at the time. And they raised four children there. And then we moved to Bethnal Green when I was four. And I just think they tried their best, but there were two people in their 20s with four kids, and they couldn't really articulate their own trauma, really. That's all I can say. I don't want to criticize them, because I know how difficult it is to be a parent, and I think they tried their best.
Your dad was a lorry driver. Did that mean he was quite an absent father, that he wasn't around that much? Or what was he like as a dad?
My dad, he's still alive now. His father was a lorry driver. His father used to be a docker and then became a lorry driver. And my dad became a lorry driver. And my dad, it's very funny. He was around. He didn't go traveling too far, but he always loved to fiddle. My dad, every job had to have a fiddle. So, and even now he sits down with my kids who live quite a middle-class life now, and their Cockney granddad comes around and they love to hear him tell us about the fiddles, granddad. And he said, well, I used to get his keys and I go around there and he liked a dirty book. If I gave him a dirty book, then I could go around the back and take this and put it on the back of my motor and all that. And they sit there and they're enthralled by it. Complexities of all these fiddles.
They sounded as if they worked incredibly hard. Did you feel that at the time, that there was a very strong work ethic and that you had to get on and do something?
Yeah, my dad always got up and went to work. My mum went to work. My nan lived with us and she worked as she was 85 as a cleaner. So, and I have a very strong work ethic. And most of my friends do as well. It was the means by which we could escape. We could have a certain amount of control of our life. And it was about self-respect as well. There was lots of that. Very hard work, very hard working. My parents divorced when I was 12. Mrs. Mitchell brought up her six children on her own and still went to work and raised them. And now they're all of them are very, very successful. So there was that. Yeah, we did work very hard. I still work hard now.
And what impact do you think their divorce had on you?
It lasted for a long while. My parents first... The marriage first broke up when they were 12, when I was 12, and it finally ended when I was 16. And the funny thing is, when I was 16, when most teenagers at the age of 16 want to go and smoke dope or they want to go to pubs and start getting drunk, I became a born-again Christian. I became really embraced a kind of Pentecostal, West Indian form of Christianity.
Because was that a response to the divorce, do you think? Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. It was about trying to find some kind of order for my... I didn't know who I was. I didn't know my place in the world. I didn't understand existentially what the meaning of my life was. There was no moral compass for me. And then I lasted about 7 or 8 months. And then I had a slight breakdown, and Mrs. Mitchell helped me to come out of that. And she was very kind. And then I kind of, and since then I've always had a healthy suspicion of any kind of ideology in religion. I've always, because I was so looking for an answer myself, and it wasn't where I found it, that I've always had a healthy suspicion because of that. So that's what happened to me.
And you're a humanist now, but how long did it carry on for? How long did you feel a sense of sort of religious purpose? And then how did the breakdown happen?
It was weird. We used to go to different churches and go to Bible meetings. And I remember once going to Birmingham to go and visit a church in Birmingham and falling asleep in the van on the way back and then waking up and hearing somebody talk about birthdays. And the pastor said, well, we don't have birthdays anymore. We don't celebrate birthdays. And I remember waking up and thinking, oh God, what am I doing? And then somebody said to me, and then about a couple of weeks later, there was one man who I admired greatly. I thought he was a real spiritual, he had a real spiritual quality to him. He was somebody I looked up to. And they said that we're going to go to Leicester Square to save homosexuals. And I, at the age of 16, I remember saying, save them from what? I don't understand what you're going to save them from. And this man who I really admired said to me, well, you're not one, are you, Eddie? And I suddenly, it frightened me because I suddenly saw what was on the surface was this lovely, kind spirituality. Underneath it was a dogmatism. And it frightened me because it was very similar to the racist dogmatism that I heard from the NF supporting working class when I was younger. And it scared me. And when I was a kid, the baddies were the NF and the goodies were, I suppose, the more progressive, you know, the left wing, the people who facilitated the multicultural, multiracial upbringing that I was lucky enough to live in. And that meant zero tolerance for prejudice and you listen to ethnic minorities and you embrace diversity. And it was very traumatic for me. Whenever I see that, whenever I see an ideology where there's dogmatism in it, it always touches a nerve with me, always.
So is it almost as traumatic to lose your faith as the trauma that sort of drove you to the faith?
No, it wasn't, because what happened to me was I went to drama school. I finally got into drama school. I was working in a menswear shop from a man called Mr. Bennett, who was an East End bookmaker and ran a menswear shop. And he said to me, what do you want to do? I said, I wanted to be an actor. And he said, if you get into drama school, I'll pay. And I got into a drama school eventually after 2 years. And he paid my first year's fees. And I had to win a scholarship to stay. But when I was at drama school, for the first 3 months, they teach you how to breathe. And there was a Buddhist center in Bethnal Green, a very famous Buddhist center. And I went there to kind of learn this breathing meditation because I wanted to get my breath deeper and more centered. And then I started to attend lectures and read books that they gave me on Buddhism. And one of the main teachings of Buddhism that appealed to me was this idea called anatman, which is no self, which is the idea that human beings are not fixed eternal selves. They don't have a soul. They're actually part of what the Buddha called the great becoming. So they're actually subject to their environment. And you don't have to define yourself. You don't have to think of yourself as a fixed thing. What you are is an ever-changing thing. And that you can, once you accept that, then you can change. And that I found that very, very liberating. Plus, at that time, I was also studying acting and acting techniques about creating character. So I then began to question my own definition of myself. My own, the first thing to go was my own insecurities. I'm afraid the confidence and arrogance took much longer to go. Eventually, that went too.
But why did you go into acting? Because you say that you knew you wanted to be an actor, but that's quite a strong statement to make when you're sort of 14, 15, to know if you haven't done very much of it before, if you presumably hadn't gone to the theatre that much.
I left school at 15 with no qualifications. When we was at school, we used to do plays and I used to enjoy the plays, but there was no way I'd ever thought it was something I could do professionally. And when I left school at 15, the first job I got was that actually in a wood factory, as a labourer in a wood factory at 15, and then I became a printing apprentice. I used to dance a lot. Me and the guys from the estate, we used to love to dance to James Brown and what we used to call Rare Groove. And then somebody saw us in a club and said, would you guys like to be extras in the film? And we jumped at the idea, and they were paying us lots of money to do it, like 50 quid a day or something, which is a lot of money then. And I went on a film set, and I saw an actor do a scene, and something in my mind just said, I can do that. That's what I can do. And from then on, I just wanted to be an actor. It wasn't going to the theatre at all. It was actually being on a film set.
But it also sounds as if your world or your life had almost become increasingly alienating. And I just wonder whether acting was also a way to sort of somehow escape that or see the world through different eyes, look at things differently.
Yeah, it's to understand. I needed to understand. I still have now a great need to understand things. I always feel like I'm catching up because I haven't got an academic education. So I'm always trying to read books and trying to read things. And trying to understand philosophy and politics and economics. And I don't read, when I'm not working, I don't read much fiction because I read fiction all the time for work. So I read books on economics and philosophy and race and things. So there was within me a great need. I think that 16-year-old kid who became a born-again Christian, it was the same thing. It was a need to understand in order to survive. I felt that the world was confusing and chaotic, and I thought it shouldn't be this chaotic. It shouldn't be this confusing. I need to understand. And so that's what I've been trying to do ever since, really. And acting is a form of that. It's an attempt to understand. I'm still struggling to understand my place in the world now.
What was your first major role, or the first role that you really thought, right, that's it, I am an actor? Was there one moment when you thought, I can do this, I've actually started sort of something that I want to do for the rest of my life?
Well, I used to do fringe plays all the time when I left drama school. And I was learning to act above all these pubs in London doing all these different plays. And I was attending extra lessons three nights a week. Even after I left drama school, I was obsessed with learning how to act. And there was one performance, I think it was one kind of restoration play. I was always the old man, by the way. I was never the dashing young bloke. I was always the old man with gout or something like that. But there was one play where I actually realized I could do it. It was after about four or five years. And I thought, my God, I can do this. And it was terrifying. Really interesting was how scared I was. Because
why?
I suddenly realized that there was no excuse anymore. It was almost like I'd given up being a child. This is what I can do. No one else in my family, no one else in my social circle knew how to do this. And suddenly this was something I had to do. I realized I could do it. And then professionally, it took another 5 or 6 years. And I did my first paid theatre job was Chipping Norton Pantomime. And I was a clown in their pantomime. And it was career-wise for the films, when I did Vera Drake and 21 Grams in the same year, one playing an American Baptist minister and one playing Reg in Vera Drake, two very different characters, and both films got Oscar attention. And because I was a character actor who played two different parts in both those films, I suddenly had a career on both sides of the Atlantic, which was very fortuitous.
It must have been a real struggle, though, to start with. You said you didn't really start making money till you were in your 30s. Did you ever think of quitting, or did it feel like a vocation you had to keep going?
I never felt like quitting. Because I was learning so much as well. I was learning so much about, you know, like there was one play where they asked me to play Caligula. Like I said, it was, and I had to study existentialism. I didn't even know what existentialism was. And suddenly I would sit with all these actors, experienced actors who had been to university and had a great education. And they were so kind. They all sat with me and they gave me their time and they gave me their attention. And I began to understand. So actually, it was like going to university for 5 or 6 years. All I had to do was keep working. Was to be in the daytime maybe to sell theatre tickets or to be a labourer or to be a printer. But I always thought I could do this. There was a point I told you, that point where I said, well, I knew I could do this. I knew how to do it. There is something in me that's quite stubborn. I do have this thing where I think, well, if they can do it, I can do it.
You're listening to Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester, Alice Thompson, and our guest this week, the actor Eddie Marsden. There'll be more from us after this. To celebrate the beginning of spring, save 50% on full digital access to The Times and The Sunday Times for 6 months and stay well informed on the latest stories. Visit thetimes.co.uk/sale/past imperfect and subscribe today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hold up.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester, Alice Thompson, and our guest this week, the actor Eddie Marsden. Now that you've made it and you're incredibly successful, does it frustrate you that the left sometimes sort of romanticise poverty and idealise the sense of working class?
I mean, I am of the left. I'm just sort of not that far left. One thing I think they misunderstand is the need to the aspirational working class. And one of the things I found problematic is the left have a narrative, and their narrative is that their ideology, socialism, will solve these problems for these people. But it depends on these people being an homogenous group. And what happens is, it is in a sense a kind of narcissistic narrative for those of the left, because they think, you be what we define you as, and we will rescue you. And actually, when I look back at my mother, when my mother got bought my father, and she bought our council house when she was 16, when I was 16, she bought it for the first time, and she suddenly had a property, and other women, and I could see Mrs. Mitchell and other women working hard. What I don't think the left understand is that aspiration isn't only material, it's also psychological. It's about having control of your life. It's about having autonomy. And that's what they don't understand. So they look at someone like me as, and they say, well, you doing that is a betrayal to your class. And you say, no, you don't understand. Me doing this I needed to do this in order to survive. I needed to have a certain amount of control of my life. And that's where I think the big mix-up is.
So that you got into trouble with the Corbynistas a few years ago for saying you preferred dinner parties to pubs. Yeah. And this, I've got it here. You said, where I grew up, pubs were often the places where men talked bollocks and then came home and beat up their wives. I like dinner parties. People share ideas and men often take their wives. I'm sorry if that makes me a traitor to your definition of my class. Why do you think that irritated them so much?
Because they thought I was saying that all working class people a wife beaters who go, and that's not what I was saying.
Yeah.
I was saying in my experience, I still have it now. I don't like pubs. I still don't like pubs. For me, pubs, where I came from, in my experience, and this is just my experience, represented stagnation. I would see men go to pubs and talk like they could run the country and manage the England football team, and they'd never leave the pub. And also, when they came out of the pub, everybody would be scared. You wouldn't know how your dad would come home, in what mood he would come home. So I've never been a big fan of pubs for that reason. Mm-hmm. I was actually trying to say that this is the result of domestic violence. But people of the left just pounced on me and saw me as a class traitor. And I'm not a class traitor.
Do you think that's because Britain's just too obsessed still by class? And why do you think the British find it so difficult even to say when they do become middle class, or, you know, a lot of the Corbynistas were actually middle class? Why do they find it so hard to feel aspirational, you know, want to be aspirational, or admit that they're aspirational?
I think it's probably because from my experience, it's based on their own guilt about their privilege. I think that they feel like they feel guilty because they are born into a more middle-class life, and therefore they need to do something for those people less privileged than them, which is admirable. And there's lots of people I admire who've done incredibly good things, incredibly kind things, and have been very generous. The problem is that there are people with really good intentions, but human beings are, to a certain extent, we all of us are narcissistic. So every story is about ourselves. And quite often when these people of for instance, the Corbyn element that dislikes me, what I find difficult about them is they want to rescue the working class, but actually it's about them, and they're in a film. They're in a world where there's goodies, baddies, and they're the heroes. If you challenge that narrative in any way by saying, well, actually, some people want to be aspirational, some people want to have control of their lives, it challenges their narrative, because they can't then sit at dinner parties and say, look what I've done. I find it with filmmakers as well, quite a lot of left-wing filmmakers, when they go and find young actors, young kids who've never acted, and they go, I found this kid, and I'm going to put them on a screen and watch how wonderful they are. And then they leave that kid, and the kid flounders, doesn't have a career, and then has a breakdown a few years later. And I always think about that. I always think, well, hold on a minute. I'm sure on every estate, you go on that estate and you always find a kid and you think, I'm going to find this kid and I'm going to, and look how generous I am. I think about three or four doors away, there's a kid somewhere who goes in the library every day and reads plays and wants to be an actor, but you're not interested in them because mm-hmm. they're doing it themselves. You want to be, it's all about you discovering somebody. It's you helping somebody.
So it's almost like a savior complex rather
yes,
than
action. It's a savior complex. And if you challenge that savior complex, then suddenly your betrayal. You don't want anyone to be saved. And it's not true. I believe 100% in the need for meritocracy. I believe in a redistribution of wealth. I believe that someone like me should pay higher taxes. I believe in freedom of movement. That's why I campaign for a people's vote. I believe in that everybody should have the means by which they can fulfill their potential. I 100% believe that. And I believe that capitalism, if it's left unchecked, will never create a meritocracy. The problem is that I think that the human beings, you create a meritocracy, and human beings need to find their own volition. They need to find their own autonomy. And that's not selfishness. That's quite often to do with them dealing with their own psychological makeup and their own and the own psychological dynamics of their upbringing. That was my experience. My friends now who are head teachers and running academies and running businesses, their impulse to do that didn't come from privilege. It came from adversity.
So in a way, for the privilege, do you think then the ideology is almost a self-indulgence or a luxury, that they can afford to be ideological because they've got enough wealth themselves?
I don't think it's as black and white as that. You know, I don't think human beings are as black and white and binary as that. I honestly think they're trying to do good. But human nature is such that it's always corrupted by ego. Even as an actor, I know as an actor, when I give a performance, and if I'm being egotistical, it's not as good a performance as if I'm not being egotistical. So therefore, I think it's the same with these people who are trying to do good. I don't want to demonize them at all. I honestly think they are good people. They're trying to do good. They're just not aware. They have a blind spot about a certain aspect of their personality. I have it. We all have it. You know, we all have egos. We all do things and think it's all about us. You know, every time you give to charity, part of you thinks, God, I'm great for giving to charity. We all do. It's human nature. So it's not that binary, really.
One of your upcoming roles is in Ridley Road, which is a BBC drama set in the East End of London about a group of working class Jewish people who took on the anti-Semites and the British Nazi Party. Was there a particular reason that you chose that, or was it just a very good part?
No, Sarah Soleimani, the writer, she contacted me. I met Sarah in LA when we were doing, when I was doing Ray Donovan, and she was a showrunner then, writing over there. And she's a Jewish girl. And then when I came back to London, Ray Donovan finished. She phoned me and said, I've written this part for you of Solly Malinowski in this adaptation of, I think it's Joe Bloom's novel, Ridley Road. And she said, would you do it? And nobody had ever written anything for me before, so I was very honoured about that. She knew that I'd campaigned against anti-Semitism. And I, and I was desperate to do something that helped, to help, really, that was constructive, that wasn't just arguing on social media. Because Sarah said a great thing. She said, social media is an argument that you will never win, but art is persuasion. And I was really grateful for her to have the opportunity to do something constructive and play this part and do this. And it's a great script, great drama. And it talks about working class Jewish people taking on anti-Semites in the Nazi party. And I was very, very grateful for the chance to do it.
Did you yourself witness that kind of prejudice and racism when you were growing up in the East End?
Yeah, all the time. Mm. All the time.
What happened?
The NF used to walk down Bethnal Green Road, and sometimes they'd go into the Bethnal Green Road. There'd be estates off Bethnal Green Road, and sometimes they would go off the estates and they would throw bottles at my friend's windows and smash their windows. I once, when I was about 16, 17, I once came out of a club with a black friend of mine, Raymond, and then a car pulled up beside Raymond. And somebody in the back seat, wound down the window and grabbed his jumper and called him a black bastard and drove off, dragging Raymond on the road. And I was drunk. Oh. I wasn't brave. It was bravado. I grabbed his feet and me and Raymond were dragged along the road. And then they let us go and we bounced. It was on a dual carriageway very close to where the Olympics was. So there was lots of racism. Friends of mine suffered a lot. It's very interesting. Tower Hamlets was going through in the 70s and 80s, it's kind of what the country is now vocalizing now. People are trying to work out who they are in a world of incredible change. But when you have an area like Tower Hamlets and other areas in the country of poverty, which is always subject to an unbelievable pace of change culturally, then people will react violently to it. 50% of people react violently, 50% of people will embrace the change.
Do you worry that anti-Semitism seems to be coming back, or that the sort of, you know, anti-immigration aspects of Britain now, that we've become less tolerant almost, or as intolerant as we were when you were growing up?
I'll tell you what. When we were doing Ridley Road, I was talking to a rabbi, a female rabbi, and she came from London and she'd moved to Manchester. And when she was in London, she was very, very pro-left and very progressive. And she said, most of the racism that all of us do is subconscious. We don't realize we're doing it because of our own implicit bias. So we have to listen to ethnic minorities when they say, listen, when you do that, it means this happens to us. And if you listen to them and then you go, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that, and then you change. The people of the left, because they were so sure that what they were doing, that they were morally right, that they were trying to be kind. And when the 85% of the Jewish population was saying, listen, this is terrifying us because of what's happened in our recent history. This is terrifying. And they were going, no. Let me tell you about anti-Semitism. Let me tell you. And that's what I find the most offensive thing. I can almost forgive. If we believe there's systemic racism, then there will be implicit bias between all human beings, because human beings are subject to the environment. It's like the concept of original sin. And therefore, the way out of that is honesty and forgiveness. But it's when you deny it within yourself, and when the people who are suffering from your actions, even if they are inadvertently suffering from your actions, even if you don't mean to do that to them, and then you're going, no, let me tell you about that, I think is wrong.
So you made a film with your family during lockdown, didn't you? And your wife, who's normally a makeup artist, was the director, and your children were involved as well. How did that all come about?
My agent phoned me and said, I was in the middle of lockdown. She goes, I've got a job for you in location. And I said, I can't leave the house. She goes, no, the location is your house.
Nightmare, isn't it?
Well, it was all practical. It was a story with a father and two sons in lockdown. And,
was your dog in it as well?
No, my dog wasn't in it, actually. We had to send my dog to my mother-in-law's. And then David Threatnell lived around the corner, so he could get there on his motorbike, and without going near anyone because it was the height of lockdown. And so it was COVID safe for him. And it was perfect. So I don't think I got it because of the job. I got it because of the practicalities of it, really. And my two boys did it with me and my wife shot it. And it was great fun. It was good for the kids to learn.
And have you missed flying backwards and forwards to Hollywood, or has it been a relief to be trapped in one place?
Oh, it's been a relief. I did it for 8 years. I did it. It was exhausting after a while. I used to do it every weekend. And it's just to not, even now, my wife was saying to me the other day, how to not be jet lagged is such a nice, for me not to be jet lagged is such a nice feeling. I used to be jet lagged all the time. All the time.
And what about dinner parties? Are you ready for them again? Or are you now going to start going to the pub, do you think?
I think, I'd love to go to the pub with Owen Jones. That'd be great fun. no, I do. I do miss dinner parties. I miss talks with friends. And see, all that came, what that actually came from was when I was a young actor, you used to, somebody would invite you to their house and have a dinner party. You'd listen to these people talk about concepts you never heard before. And I used to think, I used to drink it all in. It was fascinating for me. And then you go back to Bethnal Green and the pubs didn't appeal to me.
Are you very different to your father when you're bringing up your children, do you think? I mean, how are you with them? Do you do stuff with them? And do they all like acting with you?
I'm more around in a sense that I would come home every Sunday and cook a Sunday dinner and I'm more invested in their education, much more. Their education is very important to me and I read to them at night. One of my sons were reading Northern Lights and my other son were reading The Power. So, and we talk about that. I try not to be like my father, but sometimes I hear my father's voice and I think, oh God, he's popped up. Like we all do. I think, oh my God, I'm my mum. Oh my God, I'm my dad. So, I am different, but my life is much more comfortable than my father's. I think the trauma that he suffered as a kid and was much harder than mine.
But in some ways, your children's upbringing is also incredibly different to yours. But is there anything that you think they're almost missing out on as a result? Is there a sort of resilience that you get from not having it all comfortable?
Yeah. Yeah. There's something that a lot of my friends, we all talk about, is you work so hard to provide for them and then you realise that you're taking away incentive for them, which is very, very difficult, which is a very difficult balance. There was something about my upbringing that I loved also was when I talk about short-termism, one of the best things about short-termism is immediacy. You know, someone would have a party every week. You know what I mean? You'd always, there'd always be someone somewhere having a party. You'd have a knees up or a dance or, you know, or they would, what they used to call blues, which are these reggae things, where someone, you'd go in and someone would get a load of drinks and you'd all, I miss that. I miss that immediacy. Of it all, yeah.
And looking back at yourself now, at the age of 12, when your parents split up, what do you wish that you'd known that you know now?
I think I wish then I knew that it's okay not to know. It's okay not to be sure. There was something I read once in my mid-20s, is that ignorance is a human condition, and don't be afraid of ignorance. And it took me years to learn that. I used to be ashamed of my ignorance. And I hid behind this kind of tough guy, working class persona. That's why when you first talked about the difference between privileged actors and working class actors, why I kind of resisted that I had used it in a very manipulative way when I was younger. And actually it was because I was scared of being ignorant. Scared of asking questions. And then when I asked questions, people were very, very generous with me. I think when I was younger, I always felt stupid. I always felt ugly as well. I'm a very strange looking man. That's been one of my hang-ups, I think.
Do you think you'd have been a worse actor, though, without some kind of struggle?
Yes, but I don't think the struggle is necessarily to do with class. I think the struggle is more to do with family dynamics than to do with class. Because my father's parents died by the time he was 12. My mother's father took his own life at 15. That's not class. That's something else. That's family. And that could happen in any family. And I know actors who have had privileged lives but have suffered incredibly trauma. So that's not necessarily class. That's just being a human being and needing to understand in order to cope, really.
And do you actually quite like your looks now? Because they are, in a way, they're just memorable but forgettable, which is also rather incredible because you can just play so many different roles, can't you? Do you feel now as you're older that you're glad that you look like you do?
Yeah, someone once said to me, listen, the uglier you get, the more you work, and I'm working an awful lot. I think, I'm unconventional looking. I'm the other. I'm not us. I'm the other. So in a sense, I can always, and people's idea of the other is always very diverse. And I think that's my advantage. I don't think I'm conventional looking. If I'm not conventional, then I'm unconventional. So in a story, I'm always the unconventional, the other. And it gives me, and it means I can always work. Well, I'm also not very that kind of East End persona that I think Ray Winston and Danny Dyer do so well. I think they do that much better than I do. I was never very good at it, really. So I had to become somebody else. No one asked me to be me. They always ask me to be someone else, which I quite like.
I wonder whether your advantage is that you've always slightly been an outsider. So you're an outsider in your estate. You're an outsider in the left under Jeremy Corbyn, and you're an outsider to some extent in Hollywood. And is that perhaps your advantage?
That's on a surface level, maybe. I mean, in my life, I'm not an outsider. In my life, I'm fortunate enough to have a very, very good life. I have really good friends and a good wife and a good marriage. I don't feel like an outsider.
Did you feel like you're an insider then? Do you feel like,
I feel like I fought hard not to be defined. And I think when you're not defined, you can appear to be an outsider, because that means that many people have many different opinions of you, which I don't mind really, because none of them are true. I mean, I just think people have many different opinions of me because I'm not, I'm never, when you see me, I'm never me. Do you know what I mean? I mean, if you watch Deadpool, some Corbyn supporters literally think I'm a paedophile because they see Deadpool. One of them said, how can you stand up against anti-Semitism? You played Himmler.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you kind of think, well, I'm not those people. I'm not. I'm playing human beings. And some people, I did a film called Still Life, where it was this lovely man who buries people who when there's no one to bury. And some people, he's almost angelic. And some people think that it's all, none of it's real.
Eddie Marson, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester, Alice Thompson, and our guest this week, the actor Eddie Marson.
This is a Wireless Studios production produced by Ben Mitchell.
To make sure you never miss an episode, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts and listen back on the Times Radio app.
We'll be back with another Past Imperfect next week.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode or others in this series, please go to our podcast page or website, where there are links to charities and organisations who are there to help.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.